was lunch. Okay. So there's one book I read many years ago. The title was Theory and Practice of Tibetan Buddhism. I think it's been retitled. I think the book companies sometimes, they get you to buy the same book twice by changing the title and the cover, you know. at any rate, the reason I mention that is because there's sometimes we study and we think this is sort of theory or philosophy, and we may be more prone to be interested in that rather than practice, say meditation, or practice also includes devotion, offerings, various kinds of practices of reciting mantra and so forth. But the two are very important. Both are very important. So that's why in mentioning about this, the four seals, the first seal, that all compounded phenomena are impermanent, we'll do some meditation on death and impermanence, so sort of to try to integrate into that. But before I begin, one of the members had mentioned that I didn't give a chance for question and answer this morning, so here's your chance. Ask away. Don't feel shy. I see some people. Yeah? Anyone have a question? Yeah, there's a question.
Venerable, is there a relationship between the first and the second seal?
Again?
Is there a relationship between the first and the second seal?
Is there a relationship between the
first and the second seal?
First and second what?
Seal.
Oh, seal, seal. Well, yes. As I mentioned before, in the Theravada tradition, there's some enumerations where they, the first two seals say, all phenomena are impermanent. All phenomena are suffering. All phenomena are empty. So here, the first two are differentiated because not all phenomena are impermanent. We mentioned it, and we mentioned this morning, you recall that. And not all phenomena are suffering because, say for instance, the Buddha's body. Am I doing something? Say for instance, the Buddha's body, which according to the Theravada point of view, is a result of his past karma before he achieved enlightenment, they believe. So it is a contaminated body, and therefore the nature of suffering. But from the Mahayana point of view, the Buddha was an emanation and already enlightened, and that body, any time that there is something that has arisen because of uncontaminated karma, that is not of the nature of suffering. Say, for instance, if you were to have a direct insight, direct realization of emptiness, that state of mind creates karma. And while holding that state of mind, the various activities that you do create what are called uncontaminated karma. So there's a relationship between the two in that those two first two seals differentiate from the we can see that they are differentiating that not all phenomena are suffering, not all phenomena are impermanent. But other than that, there are other relationships between them, because for instance, when we talk about the different, here's another approach to these four seals, we could say. We perceive phenomena through the lens of our ignorance and our preconceptions. Various kinds of projections that we have sent out onto phenomena that prevent us from seeing them as they actually are. To be able to get to the point to understand emptiness, the fact that phenomena appear to be inherently existing, somehow truly existing, and what that means, right now those may only be words to you. You may not, you know, there's not a clear understanding of what that means, how that appears to us, or the fact that the self appears to have some kind of real, substantial existence back there within our body and mind. What we want to be able to do eventually is to realize that phenomena are devoid of that self that we perceive within them. So the first two seals are ways to begin to approach that, to see that we project upon phenomena intellectually with our mind, that there's a certain endurance in them, a certain durability, permanence in them, whereas realizing that they are impermanent is in a sense removing that, seeing the emptiness of that projection. So that meditating on impermanence, studying about this, helps us to approach and to get an understanding of how we can understand emptiness. Also, we ordinarily, intellectually project upon phenomena that are pleasant to us, and they are, from a Buddhist point of view, they are pleasant to us because of our karma. We've created some karma in the past to experience them as pleasure. Some people find, as Sister Suki this morning was talking about durian, some people perceive durian as very pleasurable, right? Some of you like durian? Yeah. Some people, if you brought me durian, you wouldn't be doing me a favor. Some people don't perceive it as pleasurable. So it depends on your karma, right? So with respect to things that we find pleasurable, because of our karma, we're unaware of that, we project upon them that they are the nature of happiness. They're somehow they are of a happy nature, like a little puppy dog or a porpoise. What are the psychologists, sociologists found that some face with big eyes in proportion to the face is perceived by humans as more endearing. Have you heard that? You know, like the panda bear or the porpoise or something. Or a little child, their eyes are larger in comparison to the proportion of their face than a human's eyes are, so they appear more endearing. It's not as though just because something appears to be attractive doesn't mean that it is a real source of happiness. So to help to remove, you know, if we can understand that and we can consciously meditate, when we experience things that we find pleasant, to remind ourselves that they are actually devoid of that extra layer that we're putting on them. They are attractive in the sense, conventionally, they are attractive because of our karma, and they do bring us some relief by perceiving them or engaging with them. But to understand that our mind may be projecting upon them a source of happiness that doesn't really reside there. That can help you also to understand, to prepare you for the meaning of emptiness. In this sense, that it's a similar kind of thing. There's something that's appearing from phenomena, a sense of them being truly existent, inherently existent, that is not really there. So impermanence and the seal that all contaminated phenomena are of the nature of suffering, they help you to gradually understand this third one. When we talk about the Four Noble Truths, which we dwelt on a little bit yesterday, if you go into more detail about the Four Noble Truths, each of the Four Noble Truths have four factors related to them. So there are four truths. Each of them have four factors, so they call the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths that help you to understand them more clearly. So the the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, the factors are that suffering is impermanent. Suffering is actually the nature of suffering. Dukkha is real suffering. Suffering is empty, and suffering is selfless. So when we talked about the four seals, remember the third seal was all phenomena are empty and selfless. So those two factors are conflated into that point, that aspect of the Four Noble Truths. So these four seals do appear in other contexts, but they are indicative of, the reason that they're called the four seals here and used in that sense. You know what the word for seal is in Sanskrit and in Indian language? Mudra. Mudra can mean various things. It can mean hand gestures, or it can refer to a person, or it can mean a seal. So when we talk about the Mahamudra, you may have heard that. Have you heard the Mahamudra? Mahamudra is a name that's sometimes attributed to both the object and subject that realizes emptiness. The object of emptiness itself, the subject that realizes that, is called the Great Seal, because all phenomena, as in this, of these four seals, the third seal, all phenomena are empty and selfless. That is kind of like a defining phenomena, a defining characteristic of phenomena. Now, I don't think I've answered your question in a way that, you know, someone who's more studied and realized would say there may be some other connections between the first and second of the seals, but that's what comes to my mind right now. Okay. Oh, you have a follow-up. Okay. Like in the press conferences, you only get one follow-up.
It's a separate question, actually. Is there a difference between the bliss experienced by an arhat and the bliss experienced by a Buddha? Both Buddha and arhat experience true cessation in the continuum, but to me it seems that Buddha can experience greater bliss because of his ability to expand bodhicitta.
There's one word I'm not catching in there. Bliss, are you saying?
Sorry?
Is there...
Bliss.
Say again?
Is there a difference between the bliss experienced by
bliss?
Arhat?
What are you saying? Bliss?
Bliss, that's
bliss.
Right.
So is there a difference between the happiness or bliss or pleasure of
experienced
arhat?
By an arhat, uh-huh, and that experienced by a Buddha? Because both actually experience true cessation in the continuum, but I think a Buddha can experience greater bliss because of his ability to expand bodhicitta.
Yeah. Oh, the Buddhist mind, yeah. And there is a great debate over the centuries. You know, there are a lot of things... Here you're at a very interesting place in Singapore. We have Malaysia close by, where there's so many Theravada teachers also here. So you have familiarity more than a lot of people in the world. Sometimes people either are familiar with the Theravada tradition or the Mahayana tradition, but you have a little more exposure here. Over the centuries, there would be debates about a similar kind of question that you're asking. Say, for instance, in the Theravada tradition, there's a question in their mind sometime when in the Mahayana Sutras it says, the bodhisattvas go from bliss to bliss as they're approaching Buddhahood. They're going from bliss to bliss, from happiness to happiness. They're getting more and more happy. Whereas the sense of the bliss of nirvana, remember we said the fourth seal, nirvana is bliss? The sense of that is not so much a positive, you know, what we consider bliss, like in American street slang that we talk about bling. Have you ever heard that term? Like, you know, golden things you wear to sort of impress people, or when something is very vibrant, there's a lot of bling there, you know, like the fluorescent lights, you know, when you go into some what's it called downtown, the casino, or is that what it's called? You know, there's certain kind of something that catches your attention, like this is real happiness. From a Theravada point of view, the bliss of nirvana is one in which you have subdued all of the discordant factors, so your mind is at peace. But it doesn't sort of imply a constant positive bliss in the same way that the bodhisattvas are said to experience as they ascend, because of the very factor that I think you were alluding to, because of their, in addition to having a realization of emptiness and, of course, renunciation, the Hinayana arhats have, they have this great bliss, this great mind, compassionate mind of bodhicitta. And in doing so, they accumulate much more merit. Generally, we say that the pathway that leads to all of these goals is one where you you have to accumulate both merit, which means virtuous karma, like as we do when we make offerings, we practice patience, we meditate and so forth. These things are associated with conventional truth, the accumulation of merit. The accumulation of merit is what brings about the ability of the Buddha to manifest the form bodies that other people can see. In addition to that, we need to have a collection of wisdom, which comes about through meditating on emptiness. So the Hinayana arhats have a certain collection of wisdom, not the same collection of wisdom as the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas, because it has not been supported as it was developed with this collection of merit, but they don't have the vast collection of merit of the Bodhisattvas or of the Buddha. So the Buddha's mind, whatever the Buddha's mind experience, whatever he experiences, or we say whatever she experiences, doesn't have a gender. Buddha doesn't have a gender, right? Did you know that? Right? Just whatever the Buddha experiences is great bliss. They say the one taste, the single taste of great bliss. Even so, for instance, if we see garbage in the street, dog excrement, smelly stuff, we might try to avoid it because not only does it appear to our senses, to our eyes and to our nose maybe, as unpleasant, we don't have, our karma is such that if we were to have to sit there and smell it or see it, we would be unhappy. We would we wouldn't be able to perceive that as pleasant. But the Buddha perceives that pile of garbage in exactly the same pleasure that he perceives any other pleasant object. Everything to the Buddha's mind is experienced as great bliss. So that's a big difference between the Buddha's experience and that of the Hinayana arhats. Their experience is one of kind of, what could we say, mellow? Would you say that someone is mellow, you know, or chilled? I don't know. I don't associate with many people, many young people in the States, but I hear sometimes, you know, the colloquial expression is like, chill out, man. Do you know what that means? It means like kind of calm down, kind of like, this is kind of like nirvana, you know, like, I'm chilled. So there's a little sense of that. It's not as though the Hinayana arhats do not experience pleasure, because if Shariputra or Mahamoggallana, the two disciples of the Buddha, were to experience a cup of mango juice or something that generally is pleasure, they would experience it as pleasure. But their pleasure is not the same as the Buddha's pleasure, which is one of great bliss that is covers everything. Does that help? Does that answer your question a little bit? Okay. Yes. Oh, you should leave that on so they can... He has one question.
Hello. Venerable, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What was your name?
Interestingly, I have the same name as you.
Oh, George.
No.
Chernoff.
Tupton Sultan. Yes, oh. I was given that name.
I thought you were going to say Chernoff. I was my long last relative.
I was given that name a few weeks ago, and it's the first time I've used it, so it sounds
good.
Yeah,
very good. Okay.
You spoke earlier about changing. Excuse me.
Yeah, I think it's probably got a bad connection, so don't worry. You're not
okay.
At fault.
Changing one form of suffering for another. Now, my intention, and you asked this question yesterday, what's our intention of coming here? My intention of coming here is to be able to transform my enjoyment of samsaric pleasures. I'm not sure if I'm using the words correctly, but
okay.
All the concrete milkshake and all the nice things that I like in life, and I want to transform that into a greater and more pure love specifically for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I fear that if I were to love somebody 100%, it would make me vulnerable to being taken advantage of. I would lose the pleasure that I have from the validation that I get from the attention of other women, for example, right? So what advice can you give me as I change one form of suffering into love and compassion, that I don't change it into another form of suffering?
Okay, so I just so that I'm clear, when you're talking about changing one suffering, that was talking about changeable suffering yesterday, when all of the things that we experience as contaminated happiness,
yes,
the worldly happiness, like the milkshake, is the diminishing of one suffering, the thirst or the whatever on the tongue, and we're exchanging that for the suffering of the milkshake until the suffering of the milkshake is recognized as greater. That's the context that you were talking about, right? Oh, no, no, you should. In fact, that's when I had mentioned, I think in passing yesterday or today, one of the expressions that has been used, that the Buddha used to talk about his doctrine, was the middle way. So actually the middle way has very, very profound implications. The middle way in Sanskrit is madhyama, which when we talk about madhyamika philosophy and so forth, the middle way philosophy, the view of emptiness. But in general, when people talk about the middle way, they think moderation. Oh, the Buddhist monks didn't dress, in completely nakedly like the Jain practitioners, you know, the naked ascetics. They didn't dress with the great, ornate clothes and warm clothes. In fact, even the one arm being exposed, one arm covered, one arm, it's kind of a sign of that kind of middle way, that moderation. So, of course, that's an important step to make. Most people in the world would find that eminently reasonable, you know, not to eat too much until you get to the point that it begins to be suffering. That would not be controversial at all. In terms of when we talk about loving our companions and friends and trying to develop love for others also, there's an important thing to take into consideration, that much of what we call love in the world is based on attachment. We say, colloquially, we might say, I love chocolate. It doesn't mean that you want chocolate to be happy. When you say, I love chocolate, it means chocolate makes me happy, right? And so when we say that to someone, unbeknownst, you know, unless we have developed a little bit of thoughtfulness, for many people it may mean just the same thing as chocolate. That I love you means you please me, and I want you to know that, so that if I please you, we can stay together in this symbiotic relationship of pleasing one another. That can work. In fact, that works for a lot of people in the world, but that's not in a Christian sense, that's not the meaning of highest meaning of love. There are various meanings of love. This is kind of like maybe carnal love or something like that. So that particular state of mind when we say, I love you because you please me, it's based on my own desire for pleasure. It's not based on my desire to make you happy. That is a secondary element. I may try to make you happy, bring you flowers or chocolate or whatever, do errands, fix the drain or whatever, take out the garbage, in order that you continue to please me, you know, that you stay happy. It's not so much from the point of view of real love. Real love, from a Buddhist point of view, is a state of mind that perceives the basic beauty, the basic goodness of all living beings, and prefers them to be happy. What we would, in Sanskrit, that's called Maitreya. Like the future Buddha is called Maitreya, the loving one. So Maha Maitreya, great love, is not only wants others to be happy, but endeavors to bring happiness to them, not for any kind of self-gratification. So there's a big difference. There's a big difference between that. So it's just ordinary love and great love. Great difference between that and the love that we ordinarily attribute when we say, I love you. So one thing I believe that can make our relationships more durable is if we meditate on love and use those who we have this karmic relationship with, who we're not going to just discard, our companions, our family, our wives, our husbands, to meditate on love for them, not exaggerating, to use them as the focal point on the meditation of love, and around them all other sentient beings. So not as though you have only love for your companion, you have love for all living beings, and see if your reason for loving your companion can be the same reason that you have love for all sentient beings. And what is that? What is the reason that we have love for sentient beings? What is the basic kind of logical thing? If one were to be, you know, of a very unloving nature, and you have to be convinced, why should I love sentient beings? You know, what's the reason? Well, there are a couple of streams. One is to recognize the kindness of living beings. From time without beginning, from beginningless time, all living beings have had a relationship with us. Everyone that's in samsara now, we've encountered again and again and again. Some of them, of course, are not here in this world system right now. They're in other world systems. Maybe it might be an eon or two before we encounter them again, but we will encounter them again. The people here we may encounter again and again and over a short period of, I want to say short period, you know, several lifetimes in succession. But in those lifetimes, one of the most important relationships is that of the mother to the child. Every living being has been our mother numberless times, and in so doing has been incredibly kind to us. This is one of the famous meditations that the Buddha taught in Mahayana Buddhism, to remember the kindness of the mother. If you think about that, it can be incredibly energizing, incredibly moving, because a lot of people, maybe in America, I don't know if so much in Singapore, a lot of people sometimes say, oh, my mother, it's just a pain, you know. Sometimes people, having meditated on the kindness of the mother, completely change their relationship with their mother. You know, they recognize the kindness that the mother provided us with in giving us a body, putting up with the pains of pregnancy and so forth, guarding us as we were growing up so we didn't stick our finger in the electric outlet or walk into the street, or always vigilant, you know, never getting enough sleep, giving us pleasure even from her own body, the milk of her body, sacrificing so much for us, educating us. Sometimes when I think of that, everything I know, you know, even from sewing, how to sew, if something gets ripped, my mother taught me how to go to the toilet. If you really, how to say the first words, our mother taught us numberless times and protected us in other times when we were animals. You know, there's a story of the, what's it called, wild goose chase. So I find geese to be incredibly protective of their babies. Do you find that also? If you get nearby the goose, you know, out in the countryside or something, maybe even in the city here, you come close and they'll be very aggressive and keep you, try to take you somewhere else. Or if a fox is coming to the place where the babies are, the goose will fly away. They call wild goose chase. So that try to cause the fox to go away to protect the babies. So many ways our mothers have been kind to us. The mother of this lifetime has been kind to us in the same way that single mother has been kind to us numberless times in the past. Has been depthlessly kind, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says. Then you begin to realize that this particular mother we had this lifetime has not been our only mother. Every other being has been our mother and has been just as kind, depthlessly kind. When you that meditation, to realize that all sentient beings have been your mother is not easy. It's one of the more difficult realizations to make. But when you start to get an appreciation for that, you develop a warmth, what's called heartwarming love, or heartwarming attraction for sentient beings. My teacher Lama Yeshe once when this one one American disciple was sort of arguing with Lama, so one lady, one American nun, and she was very, very devoted to Lama, but sometimes she would be, you know, she would give her own opinion, and I remember Lama standing by the window after having listened to this and said, mother sentient beings, you know. So, you know, just recognizing that she had been his mother numberless times in the past, and to be patient and to be loving and to recognize that sometimes our mothers may act in ways that are harmful to us or unpleasant for us. But in the same way that if our mother were to be old, have developed dementia or something else, we might be still, even if she were to act in a very aggressive way toward us and act like she doesn't know us, we would still recognize her kindness and try to help her. Of course, there's some people would not as much. Depends on your own good heart. So that's one approach to developing real love, wanting others to be happy, having recognized our relationship with them. And then in an even more expansive way, how they've been helpful to us, is even when they were not mother, even when they were stranger or enemy, they have benefited us. The person who delivers the food to the market, or the person who prepares the food at the market that we buy, the people who have paved the roads that we drive on, all benefit us in many ways. They're kind to us. Even if you say, oh, well, they didn't intend, they're just making a buck, right? They're just making a Singapore dollar. They don't care to make you happy. The kindness of others does not depend upon their intention. The kindness of others to us depends on the result to us, if it brings us benefit. So how does the enemy bring us benefit? This really expands the mind a lot, to think of love. You know, how can you have love for the enemy? What were you going to say? The enemy gives us a chance to experience the results of our negative karma right now, and rather than being experiencing it for a very long time in the hell realms. Sometimes when karma is not ripened right now, it may ripen later when we're in the hell realms and be experienced as much more suffering. So this is like just a mild purification of that negative karma. But also in rebuking us or criticizing us or leaving us or, you know, treating us poorly, they give us the chance to practice patience. They become our guru. One of the 8 verses of training the mind says that when we encounter beings of bad character who are gripped by great suffering and negative actions, I'll practice to see them as a precious treasure. You know, someone who we can develop patience with, very difficult to find. When someone I have benefited, like say your spouse or your children or your friends, and in whom I have great hopes, kind of expectation that they'll treat me well, when they treat me unjustly, I will practice to see them as my holy guru. So even the enemies are kind to us because, yeah, gurus are not always, you know, we might think the guru is someone who's always going to treat you kindly, you know, oh, you have a problem, let me help you. Yeah, that's certainly a function of the guru sometimes. But sometimes the guru, when there is a good relationship, stable relationship with the guru can be very wrathful, cut right through your ego, you know. So the you might see, oh, the guru treated you so poorly. Actually, they were benefiting you by pointing out your faults and so forth. So that's one approach to developing a warmth for others. The other approach is what's called the equality of self and others, which is incredibly powerful for those that have an analytical mind. And that is very simply stated, but has many ramifications. And that is, we all living beings, are similar, are equal in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. Never, no living being is satisfied with this samsaric happiness they have. They always need more. It's the very nature of samsaric happiness. No living being wants suffering. When we have a chance to have a little insight into selflessness, Dzogchen Children, if we no longer have this strong grasping to this is me, you can start to see the possibility of identifying me with the totality of sentient beings. Because we are all similar in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. Right now, if we ourselves suffer, if I suffer, I go out of my way to relieve that. I'm going to put on, someone brought me some nice patches for my shoulder. Who was that? Was that here? Is it you? Uh-huh. Someone brought me. So I'm going to put on later. So I'm going to go out of my way because I want to be free of suffering. But if we can start to identify with all living beings, when we see suffering out there also, we're motivated to eliminate that suffering. And when we see others deprived of happiness, you know, not loved, not cared for, we are motivated out of this sense of equality with others, which is based more on the sense of the realization of emptiness, selflessness, starting to identify with the totality of sentient beings, the plight of all living beings, not working just for our own selfish self-interest. So those are ways that you can start to enhance the warmth by remembering their kindness and remembering and contemplating our equality with them. And then, when you think of your loved ones and you want to make that love more authentic, to try to eliminate the sense of attachment in there. If our spouse or our companions, our friends were to leave us, criticize us and leave us, most of us would feel sad, heartbroken maybe incredibly depressed. It's the topic of many of the magazines in the supermarket, you know, I don't know if you have the same kind in America, Brad left Angelina, or Angelina left Brad, or someone's leaving someone else. All of this I've mentioned before also. There was a song, rock and roll song, I think, in the 50s, My Baby Done Left Me. Or maybe it was a blues song. My baby done left me. So it's sort of the quintessential element of all blues. You've lost something. So that pain of loss of your loved one comes about because of attachment. If your love was one that was based on really wanting the other person to be happy, you could be like the arhat, like the nirvana chilled out, you know, you would notice they're no longer there, and you might feel sad that you were no longer able to contribute to their happiness because they've left. But you wouldn't be pitying, you wouldn't be sad for yourself. Does that make sense to you? Oftentimes when someone dies, a couple, one member dies, in a family, let's say, people come and they, they console the family members for their loss. They say, oh, I'm sorry for your loss. What do you say? What's the common thing you say? What is it? Yeah, condolences for your loss, I'm sorry. Actually, it's the person who died. what that means is that all of these people had so much attachment for that person, not in a positive sense, not necessarily love for that person, but they had attachment for that person who died. And now, instead of feeling a loss for humanity that person is no longer there, they feel, oh, this is a problem for me, and there's no one bringing in the money any longer. Why did they leave? You know, they take it personally. So it's a very interesting subject. Okay. So although there may be more questions, let's get on to let me continue on to our subject, and at the end I'll leave a little time for questions again. But very good questions. Thank you. So I was mentioning how it's beneficial to begin to meditate also on these things, not just to take them as theoretical concepts. Say, for instance, that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So the most efficacious, most beneficial subject to take is our own life. That I am not permanent, that I am impermanent, and in the gross sense, not yet recognizing that I am changing moment by moment, but just to center first of all on that, even that gross impermanence that we're not conscious of, that we will definitely die, that we will. It's something that if I ask you, as I said before this morning, if you will die, probably no one here would say they were not going to die. I don't know, maybe there would be someone who said they weren't going to die. But if you were rational, you would recognize that. But it's not like we don't have a taste of that. We don't have the realization of that. How can we bring that about? I mentioned one method of meditating on death this morning, imagining the time of your death and the dissolution of the elements and so forth, recognizing that this will happen to us. So this other method is called, that became popular, I think, I'm not absolutely certain, but I think through the Kadampa Geshes, it's slightly different, but it's called the 9-round meditation on death. So there are three main topics to meditate on. One is that death is certain. Our death is certain. Or you can use a different word, definite. Death is definite. If you like the word, you like the letter D. Death is definite. The second point is the time of death is uncertain, is indefinite. Can anyone here say when they're going to die? Maybe someone who's got a terminal illness, the doctor has said you're going to die within a week. Maybe they can say within a week. Even that's not certain. They might die just the next second, you know. But we don't know. The third point is, at the time of death, nothing besides the Dharma is of any benefit at all. We kind of alluded to that earlier today and yesterday also. You can't take anything with you, your friends, your companions, your wealth, your body that you've cultivated. You've gone to so many cures and baths and oils that you put on it and food that you've lavished on your body. Your body fails you at the time of death. It won't help you, and you can't take it with you. So let's take the first point. Death is definite. And you might say, well, what do I do to meditate on that? Do I just sit and say, death is definite, death is definite, death is definite? And it probably won't make much of an impact on you. It might, because keep it in mind. But there are three, that's why we call the 9-round meditation. Each of these points has 3 subtopics. So death is definite has 3 particular meditations. In the Indian context, death is kind of sometimes thought of as in a sort of human form, like Yama. Do you know what Yama is? The Lord of Death. So the first meditation is sometimes phrased like this. What is that called? Anthropomorphic, sort of making it into a human kind of thing, right? The Lord of Death comes to everyone, and there's no way to escape him or her. I mean, I want to be, you know, we're in the new age, right? Yama, the Lord of Death could be also woman. So what does that mean? This is actually very, very tasty when you start to think about it. So what you would think about, first, the first of those two part of that phrase, the Lord of Death or death comes to everyone, and there's no way to escape it. So you think, Winston Churchill. I read a history of Winston Churchill. I didn't personally, but you might say yourself. I read a history of Winston Churchill, his birth, his childhood, he grew up, prime minister during the World War II, this, and he died. Everyone that you have ever heard of in the past has died. There's no one who has lived, even Jesus Christ. Even Buddha took the aspect of dying, although he didn't have to. Is there anyone you can think of who never died? You know, think. So what you would do to really bring some taste to this is to think of tangible examples. You know, my dad and mom have both passed away, so I can think of them as saying, you know, I remember when I was a child, my mom and dad raising me, and as I grew older, then they passed away. They definitely died. See that sequence of time. Say my brothers who are still alive, to think, I've seen them as they've grown up, they're growing older, you know, matured. But having the same sense, but they too will die. Even though they're not dead yet, they will die. There's no doubt. Sometimes to use an example of another person's eventual death is easier for the ego to accept. Because if you say, I will die, the ego wants to not want to address that, right? Do you follow what I'm saying? So psychologically. So you use both people historically that have passed away. There's no one in the past that you can find who has not died. And even the people now that are living, you recognize they are the same as all the individuals of the past. There's nothing different about them. They will eventually die. And then when you contemplate this for some time, then you come back to your own self. And it becomes a little more acceptable for your mind once you've understood that other people will die. I too will die. What does that mean? It means that my existence in this body and with this particular mind, this gross mind that we have now, personality and so forth, will cease. From a Buddhist perspective, the subtlemost mind that we talked about this morning will leave this body without any memory of being Thupten Soltrim. Goes off, takes rebirth somewhere else, maybe in the hell realms, maybe as a hungry ghost, maybe as an animal. maybe after some time as a human, and once identified in that body, thinking, I am Susanna, I am Ham Chungang, I am someone else, you know, just identifying with that, not thinking of the past lives and future lives. So death, you know, to think of what the significance of that is, I will die just like all of these people of the past. Let that sink in. And the second phrase of that point was that death comes to everyone and there's no way to avoid it. So we might think, like if the police raid in the movies, you know, the police are raiding some house and you're going to get captured, kind of like the Lord of Death, right? You're going to get captured, but you can escape. You know, there's some tunnel you can escape. There's no way, when death comes, there's no way to escape death. When the time of death comes, there is no special hospital, better hospital you can go to avoid death. Of course, I'm not saying that no medical treatment can't elongate your life. You know, if you get better treatment, you may be able to live a little bit longer. But there's no hospital you can go to that will protect you from death. Do you agree? Or do you think you have better hospitals here in Singapore than we have? There's no hospital here called the Deathless Hospital, is there? That guarantees you won't die while you're there. So that's also, you know, historically, there are various stories in the Buddhist Sutras where people were in battle and they tried to protect themselves. They were about to be defeated and killed by the enemy and they tried to try to protect themselves by various means. Of course, you may be able to escape in a battle, but when the time of death comes, it's not the same as a world being apprehended by the police or in a battle that you might be able to escape. Death is something that is determined by our karma, and when our karma is exhausted, death happens no matter what you do. You may be in the middle of a sentence. You may be washing the dishes. And I've heard this. Someone told me that their companion was talking to them, having a conversation, drying the pan, and collapsed on the floor dead. You know, when the time of death comes, that's it. So that's, when you were to meditate, if you were to meditate on gross impermanence, taking the self as the main object, the first point is to meditate that death is definite, certain. I'm definitely going to die because everyone, I'm the same, I'm no different than every other living being. Animals, gods, even long life gods. There's no one who lives eternally. Even the Buddha took the aspect of passing away. The children that I see now in the street that look so young and maybe have, you know, we don't necessarily think of them dying. They will grow old, they will die. Like that, I will die. And there's no way to escape it. It's inevitable. Okay? Then, after thinking about this for some time, you can go on to the next point. The next point of this, that death is definite, is that at the time of death, there is no way to get extra life. There's no way to, there's no way to augment your life at the time of death. You know, like you can do something to replenish it. And the time that we have yet to live is constantly diminishing. These two are related. So what does that mean? When the time of death comes, you're on your deathbed, you can't simply say, as though death is at your shoulder, say, well, give me a minute. I want to do some prayers. You know, no one is the Lord of death, if you're making it human-like, or the death itself will not give you any, you know, you can't argue with death. You can't bargain with death. Classic thing you see sometime in the old movies from the 40s, in the French Foreign Legion, someone is going to be shot by the firing squad. You know, this is, and what did they do? The person who's going to be shot, they always ask, oh, can I have a cigarette before you shoot me? So the colonel gives him a cigarette, so he gets a couple extra minutes. You can't do that with death, you know, with the Lord of death. You can't ask for, you know, time for one more cigarette, or let me just make one prayer to Buddha to create some virtuous karma. When the time of death comes, there's no extra life. It's finished. It reminds me, it's just a joke, okay? Do you mind if I tell jokes sometime? You like. So there was an advertisement when I lived in Italy on TV that was very clever, I thought. So there's the same context. This guy was going to be shot by the Foreign Legion, and instead of asking for a cigarette, he asks the officer in charge to let him talk to his mama on the phone. The Italians, big thing, mama, you know, the son. Oh, mama. You know, so he's talking on his phone. It was the advertisement was for the phone company. Right? And he said, mama, you never know. You know, talking to you is, you know, how can I say? It's really saving my life, something like that, you know. So there's no, at the time of death, there's no extra life. And every second, every instant, we are approaching death closer and closer. So like this, say for instance, someone is going to be executed with a guillotine or the hanging or the firing squad or something, and they're walking, they're bound up, they're walking. In fact, sometimes they don't even want to walk, like in going to the electric chair or something. You know, the person doesn't even want to walk because they know once they get there, they're going to die, right? So they don't want to. Every step, they're getting closer and closer. Right now, every instant, not even every second, every millisecond, microsecond, every instant, we are getting closer to death. I sometimes find very powerful for my mind to think I'm falling through time. Like in an elevator, if the elevator cords were too broken and you're falling, you know, you're very scared because if it hits the bottom, when it hits the bottom, not if it hits the bottom, when it hits the bottom, you're going to die, but you don't know when. It could be just as soon as you're thinking, maybe I have a few seconds, maybe I'll say some prayers or something. Falling through time, you don't know when you're going to die. It could be any time. But every second we're getting closer to death right now. So with that kind of understanding, having contemplated that again and again with these various meditations, you're more conscious about what you do with your life. I used to, when I was waiting for the microwave to heat my hot water, it's a lazy way, you know, you heat water in the microwave. Do you do that sometimes for my coffee? So while I'm waiting, I would just sit there. And then I began to think, I should use that time because I'm getting closer to death. I should use that time for some important meditation, you know. So sometimes I would recite mantra during that time, try to collect some virtuous karma. And more recently I've been doing what's called the Tonglen meditation. Do you know, have you heard of Tonglen? Imagine taking on the suffering, like when Thupten Sulthum's question, you know, how to generate this sense of affection for others. Imagine taking on the suffering of all sentient beings as though that's mine, you know, experiencing it myself. and sending out all of my good qualities, not that I have good qualities, but my good karma, my possessions, my body, to be enjoyed by others, the same way that I would like to be protected by others. So knowing that we're approaching death with every instant can give you the motivation to make your life more meaningful. You know? So first point was, death is definite because death comes to everyone and there's no way to avoid it. Right? Second point, death is definite because at the time of death, you can't bargain. You can't get any extra life. So death is going to happen, certain. And every instant, we're getting closer. We're approaching that death. Here's another very good meditation you can use for this, that point. You may have bought something, a big bottle, economy size. What would you buy, economy size, to eat? In America, they might be Nutella. You know Nutella? That hazelnut chocolate spread or some big family size. Or peanut butter. Coffee, big. So in the Sangha, when we were at Kopan Monastery, we would have these big cans of Nescafe. And when you first look at it, you say, oh, wow, my supply, our supply, you know. But with every spoonful, it's diminishing. It's getting closer to finishing. You know, you might not notice it the first couple of spoonfuls, especially with a new jar. It still looks for, but after a couple of days, couple of weeks, it's getting down there. And it eventually finishes. When that happens to you, try to be like Milarepa, who used all of these kind of life experiences as material for his Dharma meditation. Think, like that, my life is finishing. With every small spoonful of life, every second of every instant, you know, one day gone, you might think, oh, I wasted today, but what the heck? Just a day, you know. But that's one spoonful out of your coffee pot of coffee reservoir of life. Death is definite because when death comes, there's no way, there's no extra life. You can't ask for some time out. There's another example I thought. In sports, when I was in high school, a young boy, the football team, and I think many American football is different than soccer. We call the game you call football soccer, right? You know that. So I said, there's American football. There's a different sport, kind of like rugby, but it's a little bit different. American football. So at the end of the game, there's like the clock shows 3 seconds left, something like that. So, but the coach wants to get in some play. He wants to tell the player something. So on cue, one of the players on the field falls down in agony, say, I'm injured, and the referee has to call timeout. Because there's some rule, if the player is injured, you have to call timeout. At the time of death, you can't use any kind of artifice like that to get some extra time. You know, like, oh, I can't breathe. I can't die now, or, you know, say something like that. When the time of death comes, there's no extra life, and every second we are approaching it. The third point to contemplate and to bring about a realization that death is definite is that it may not sound like a reason at first, that most of our life is spent not practicing the Dharma. If you think about it, when you get up, when you sleep at night, unless you have consciously made some special effort to dream in a special way or special motivation, your sleep is just completely samsaric. It's not practice of Dharma. When you get up in the morning, your cup of coffee, your breakfast, going to work, you may, definitely possible to transform all of these activities into Dharma activities. And that's one of the great things that you can strive to do, what we call the training of the mind, right? But most of us, we would consider that we wouldn't be able to integrate the Dharma into our life during that time. We might find a couple minutes a day when we sit, we say some prayers, or we go to the temple once a week and we offer some incense, or you study. But most of our life, not only our life right now, daily, but when we were a child, up until the time we could read and write and encountered the Dharma, maybe we didn't practice the Dharma at all. And when we get very old and infirm, it may be maybe difficult for us to practice the Dharma. So most of our life is spent without practicing the Dharma. Now, the first two reasons seem to be more logical to bring about an understanding that death is definite. That is, death is definite because it comes to everyone, and there's no way to avoid it. At the time of death, you can't get any reprieve. You can't, call time out or ask for a break. And every second we're approaching that, like falling through time, death is at some level. We don't know when it's going to be. It might be today. One of us may leave today and not be able to come back next time. But this third reason doesn't seem to be of the same logical, to bring about the understanding that death is definite, that most of our life is spent not practicing the Dharma. This third reason is said to be a reason that brings about experience. That is, if you think about that, it gives you more of an experience of what this means, that death is definite, that I must practice the Dharma. Because the conclusion, if death is definite, say to someone who is not a believer of any faith or not a believer in reincarnation, the fact that death is definite might be something very pessimistic. What's pessimistic? What's it called? Nihilistic. You're born, you live, you die. But for a Buddhist practitioner, when we recognize that death is definite, the implication of that, because we know that there will be future lives, is that we have to use the time of this lifetime to provide the causes for some spiritual evolution in the future. If we spend this lifetime knowing that death is definite, if we spend this lifetime without practicing Dharma at all, if we're not generous, if we're not kind, if we're not patient, as opposed to that, we're mean and self-centered and egotistic and selfish, we create negative karma for our future lifetimes to experience in very unpleasant circumstances without meeting the Dharma again. So the conclusion one would make from meditating on the fact that death is definite is that I must practice the Dharma. Because if I were never to die, if death was not definite, if I could just keep on living and there was no such thing as karma, I could just keep on, I wouldn't necessarily, I might think that I wouldn't have to practice the Dharma. But knowing that we definitely have to die, that we will have rebirth in the future, and the contour of all our future existences depends upon our actions, we know that we want to try to pack pack this life with as much Dharma practice as we can, to develop as many good qualities as we can. Does that make sense to you? When I was a boy, my mother used to watch this TV program in the afternoon when she was vacuuming or cleaning. I think it was called something like Queen for a Day or something like that. So once you won the first part, the first round, you won the contest, you were the queen for the day, and you got to go on the stage. They'd open the curtains, and on the stage were these aisles where there were all sorts of products. You got a certain amount of time, maybe 1 minute, and you could go around. There was simple things like food, and then there were appliances, you know, and then there was a car, and then there were cards for a vacation, and you would have the time to accumulate as many of those as you could in your allotted time, right? Does that sound like some program you ever heard? Yeah? Oh, okay. So if the person would be a very simple-minded person, they're queen for a day, they're going out, and they're just taking the food rather than the appliances or the auto or the card that signifies the vacation to the sunny islands, and the audience is going crazy, you know, stupid, you know, get the good stuff, don't waste your time on that trivial stuff. I think that's what the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas must be thinking of us. We've got this, we're queen for a day, okay? We're king for a day. We've got this certain lifespan. You know, it's definitely going to end. When that contest was over, when the minute was over, the contestant couldn't pick up any more cards, right? So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are thinking, you dummy, don't waste your time on that durian, on that, you know, the casino, on the, you know, gambling, you know, being naughty, cheating on your spouses. Get the good stuff, you know. Go get the, you know, the card that leads to nirvana, you know, to you know, that will really profit. So sometimes these kinds of examples can give you a little bit of hint. You can make your own examples when you meditate on these. So that third point, that most of our life is not spent practicing the Dharma, maybe you can see. That's kind of like the fact that death is definite, and the fact that we spend most of our life without practicing the Dharma is a shame. That gives you the feeling, that leads to the conclusion, I must practice the Dharma. That's because death is going to occur. Okay? Does that make sense? This afternoon session is also 2 hours, or is it an hour and a half? 2 hours. So we say it goes till 3:30, right? Okay. So that's the the meditation on the fact that death is definite. Let's do a short little meditation on that. Let's sit comfortably. So we keep it fresh, fresh in our mind. And while we're doing that, I'm going to put a lozenge in so I don't cough so much here. Excuse my cough. So I'll just remind you of the points and then leave some time for you to think about them. I'll bring them up one at a time and leave you a little time for each one. And you can use your own examples, contemplate, you know, the individuals you might think of that definitely will die will be different for each of you and so forth. So the first point, what we're trying to understand is that I myself will die. I'm definitely going to die. Death is definite. Why? Because death comes to everyone and there's no way to avoid it. And think what that means, that I'm going to die, that my mind leaves this body and mind, this gross mind, behind. All of the experiences of this lifetime are forgotten. It's almost like one of the first Karmapa said, at the time of death, the vision of this life is like last night's dream. You know, when you wake from a dream. Still maybe a little bit, you know, you remember it a little bit, but it's beginning to fade very quickly and becomes more and more inconsequential to you. All of the things that we thought of so important, the relationships, the status, the position, the power, the pleasures, all of that are left behind. Death is definite. This is our nature. And then think a little bit about the second point. When death approaches, there is no way to get extra time. And with every instant, we're getting closer and closer to that time of death. is definite because when death actually approaches us, when we're approaching death, we can't add anything at that time. We can't call time out, ask for a reprieve, get some extra minutes. There's no way to prevent it that way through our power, our majesty, edict, preventing death from coming to us. And with every second, every instant we're approaching death, our life is depleting. Like the can, maybe someone gave you a can of Italian olive oil that you have on your shelf, and there's a little teeny leak in the bottom that you noticed, but you don't pay any attention because it's just a little teeny leak. But over the hours and days and weeks and months, that oil keeps on coming out and eventually is depleted. In the same way, our lifespan is leaking away. So death is definite. Death is definite because it comes to everyone. We can't, if the Lord of Death approaches, we can't escape him. When the Lord of Death approaches, has reached us, we can't ask for extra time. In fact, he's approaching us with every instant, getting closer and closer. You can think of it that way. This anthropomorphic yama approaching us every second, getting closer and closer. And third, to bring about some resolution of what to do with this life, to recognize that we spend most of our life that's definite, that has this definite length, definite size, that we can't elongate and so forth. We use most of this life without practicing the Dharma. It's only just a few years in the middle of our life when we've heard the Dharma and we have some interest in practicing. Even during those years, we spend most of the time just in ordinary functions, not practicing the Dharma. Even that, there might be just a couple of minutes or a couple of hours a day practicing Dharma for a couple of years of our life. and see if you can, if you have some insight into this, even in this very first meditation. The conclusion that one would draw, logically draw, sort of spiritually significant conclusion, that the fact that death is definite, is that we must practice the Dharma all the times we have been lazy, lying on my bed, sitting when I could be up, practicing the Dharma, studying, helping others. The Lord of Death was approaching. I wasn't practicing the Dharma. Because death is definite, because this life has an end, and as we have faith that we will, our continuum will exist in the future as a result of the karmic seeds we've left on our continuum now, the Dharma practice that we've done, we must practice the Dharma. It's not something that you can just discard. Ignore. Not like that. If you get even a little flavor, a little scintilla of fragrance of that understanding, hold it in your mind. I must practice the Dharma. And then bring your attention back to the present. Any observation? Comment? What do you think? Not sure, looking at you. Were you meditating or did you doze off? This lady, how were you? Did you meditate? Yeah, you did? Yeah. How about you? The lady back by the tongue? Yeah. Did you meditate? Did you meditate? Did you spend time meditating just then or were you? Yeah, you did. Okay, good. I thought maybe you were calculating your taxes or something. Not you, no. So, this meditation can bring about some very big change in our life. As Lama Zopa said, it said in the sutras, in many places, as Lama Yeshe used to say also, that the realization of impermanence and death is an incredibly powerful understanding to have to overcome our delusions. Ultimate antidote to our delusions is a realization of emptiness. We can realize there's no self the way that our mind is grasping it to be. And in so understanding, you can eliminate the delusions, the problematic states of mind, anger, attachment, and so forth. But until you have that realization of emptiness, and while you're trying to develop it, the next most powerful realization to counteract the delusions is this understanding of impermanence and death. So the second point, so first point was death is definite. Second point is that the time of death is indefinite, is uncertain. So again, it doesn't, meditating on that doesn't mean that you simply say, you say to yourself those words, time of death is indefinite, time of death is indefinite, like a mantra. It might have some effect, but not much. You need to have reasons why that time of death is indefinite. So there are three reasons why the time of death is indefinite. One is that in this world that we live in, we call the southern continent, this world system, the lifespans are not set. There's no set lifespan. Some of the other continents, some other places you can be born within samsara, there's a set lifespan. But each of us have our own individually karmically created lifespan that we have, through our actions in past lives, have created the power to live a certain number of years. We could live less years than we had created the karma for. Say, for instance, you'd created the karma to live to 97. But because of some other negative karma you've created, you might be in a car accident and maybe you'll die at 58. So those years between 58 and 97 are sort of lost to you. But in this southern continent, excuse me, in the southern continent, there is no set time. It's no set time of life, and it's very impermanent, very uncertain. That's one point. Next point is, there are more causes of death than there are causes of life. What do you think? What are the causes of life? Do you need $1 million to live? Well, according to some people, you do. No, you don't need $1 million. Do you need the very best food, the very best bottled water? No. What do you need to live? You just need some air, breathing, some water, some food, and some little basic shelter. In growing up, maybe you need some affection to be a well-balanced person. You know, you can't deprive a person, a child, of love and expect them to grow up well. But in general, we don't need, many times we feel depressed because we're not loved. We don't have love. But if you think about it, is that one of the causes of life? Other than, let's say, other than the well development of a child growing up needs some affection from the parents, but as we get older, could we live without being loved? Say, for instance, if we were deprived of love, is that a cause of us dying? Well, it could be if we were mentally so caught up in that, became depressed and, you know, affected our metabolism and so forth. But in generally, you don't need love. You need some food, you need some water, you need some oxygen, you need some shelter from the elements so you don't get too cold or too hot. But there's very few causes of life, just a few causes of life. What are the causes of death? Some of the things, many of the things that we think of as causes of life become causes of death. Like eating. When I was in India teaching, I think it was a Kiwanis club. It was Kiwanis? Mm. There's some kind of club that the business people have. Lions Club. Is that a club? And so I was speaking about Buddhism, and one of the persons told an incident about someone. Or maybe there's a story Lama Zopa Rinpoche told. Someone was someone was a speaker at a conference, and he was eating chicken right after his speech, and the bone got stuck in his throat, and he died. So usually we we might rationalize that we eat in order to live. If you're like me, you eat to enjoy also, right? And not just to live. If you were real, arhat, a real bodhisattva, the food is more or less medicine for you. You don't relish out of attachment that special food. But because of this person relishing the chicken, eating it, and the bone got stuck in his throat, he died. So that's an example of what we think of as a cause of life, food, becoming a cause of death. Right? Many of the things like that, you might think that your car is something that helps to improve your life. If I didn't have my car, I don't know how I could live in Singapore. I don't have a car, but anyway, example. But then if you if you're traveling on the rapid highway here, have an accident and die, there's an example of what you thought was either a cause or a condition of a good life or a cause of life becoming a cause of death. Most of the things that we think of as causes of life, other than air, water, a little bit of food, and shelter, they can become causes of death. They don't necessarily become causes of death, but they can become causes of death. So that the implication of that is that the time that we will die, even if we had somehow some clairvoyance to know what karma we had to live, like 100 years, 97 years, something, even if we knew that, we can die before we can die before that time with some other karma, accident, you know, eating a bone or having an argument with someone and having a fight, falling, hitting your head on the table, dying. We can understand because of that the time of our death is not definite. Even if there were to be, and we don't know what the time of our lifespan is, even if we were to know that, we can die anywhere before that when other causes and conditions arise. The third reason is that the time of death is uncertain is that our body is very fragile. Our body is not like a big steel machine, a tank that can barrel its way through the forest, crushing the trees, you know, coming unscathed. Our body is very fragile. Sometimes being touching a little thorn, teeniest little thing, can cause some poison to be put into your body that can lead to death. When the elements of the body are out of balance, one can very easily have mental disease, do very crazy things. But the fact that our body is very fragile, also we can understand more that the time of death is impermanent. The time of death is uncertain because as we are walking down the street, we may have an accident. Because the body is not of a durable nature like boulders or, you know, the tank or whatever, we can encounter conditions for death. So an example sometimes the Buddha gave is that if you were, or Nagarjuna, I think, said, if you put a lamp on the porch in the summertime, if there's no wind, that lamp may burn out naturally to the extent of the fuel that's in the lamp, right? But because the lamp is so open to the air, a little breeze comes by, can snuff out the flame, right? Even though there was fuel left, so example in terms of lifespan, even though we might have the karma to live longer, when certain conditions, because the body is so fragile, like that lamp, when certain conditions come, they can snuff out our life even before our appointed lifespan. So this point, the second point, the time of death is indefinite, is said to bring about a greater understanding of the practice of Dharma. Remember the first point, death is definite. The conclusion of that, if you had an understanding, is I must practice the Dharma. And the significance of this meditation, that the time of death is uncertain, is that I must practice Dharma now. You know, while I'm sitting on my bed, I must practice Dharma now. Get up and do something, because I might die today. I mentioned, I'm not sure if it was this morning or yesterday, if someone were to have this, be familiar with this meditation, and every day in the morning they were to motivate and remember this and think, I may die today, and even make the decision, I'm going to die today, I have to practice the Dharma. All during their living life, that statement would have been wrong. But on the last day of their life, when they said, I'm going to die today, they're right. And their whole life would have been fruitful, because every day of their life they would have practiced the Dharma. Whereas the individual who thought, I'm not going to do things, I'm not going to die today. Not many people get up in the morning thinking that, but just oblivious of the fact, but thinking that, not thinking that you're going to die today, every day of their life that they live, that day, they're right, but on the last day of their life, they're wrong, because they die that day, right? But that person's life is spent without practicing the Dharma. So that this particular meditation on the time of death being uncertain is said to bring a greater motivating factor to our Dharma practice. In meditating on these, on death, one gets a better appreciation of gross impermanence. And then you can, as your mind has, as they say, for instance, if you were to try to realize subtle impermanence without first understanding gross impermanence, there would be some obstacle to your mind understanding the subtle. You have to understand the gross first. So this meditation on gross impermanence, meaning our death, starts to eliminate certain misconceptions from the mind that make the mind more capable of understanding subtle impermanence, the momentary change in our relationships, in our own being, and so forth. Not only are we going to die eventually, we're changing every moment. Like that one example of the when the time of death comes, there's no extra life, and every second, every instant, we're getting closer. That every instant we're getting closer is like intimating about subtle impermanence. Before we finish, are there any other questions that someone wanted to address? We've got a couple minutes. Yes. stand up and speak in a nice loud voice. Oh, he's bringing.
Okay, hi. Hello, Venerable. I have this burning question. People are living longer lives, and it's being reported as well in the newspapers and all that. So it could be attributed to maybe enhanced medical breakthrough, artificial intelligence and all that. So then how does that reconcile with the karma, you know, that we have accumulated and allocated naturally?
Right. So my understanding of that is that, say, for instance, right at this present time, generally sentient beings will, in the southern continent, will have a lifespan no more than maybe 120 years, 110 years. There may be some people that have exceptional karma that live longer. They may have some natural lifespans that are shorter. They die without accident at a shorter life. But maybe 100 at the, somewhere around 100, a little over 100. The fact that when we improve medical conditions and the availability of medication and nutrients and so forth, we may be able to live to that full extent of that life. But it's rare that you find people living, do you know, is there anyone in Singapore who's in the newspapers older than 120, 130? I think the oldest person in America just died. I just was in the newspaper yesterday, the day before, I can't remember, 120 or something like that. It is said that in earlier times, at the time of the Buddha and so forth, that it was possible that lifespans could be longer, you know, 200 years or something. You hear sometimes in the literature of people living to very long lifespans in the past, and we scoff at that, thinking, oh, that, how could that be? That's exaggeration. The fact that not everyone lived to 200 years in the past was because of the conditions. They didn't have the same good conditions of medical conditions and nutrition and so forth. So many people died inadvertently, even though they might have had a lifespan to live 150 or 200 years. They might have died at 37, or, you know, in many cultures the lifespan was even like that, 37. When I was at Sera Monastery teaching Lama Osel, I remember coming on the rickshaw with one monk who told me that he was going back to see his mom in Tibet. She was very old, and he was afraid he might not see her again. I said, how old is she? And he said, 44. And I was taken, you know, that was in Tibet, the conditions, nutrition, the oppression by the government and so forth, not the Tibetan government, the Chinese government that was overseeing Tibet, were such that the people couldn't live. So I think that's, to my mind, that's what's happening now. You will not find, even if someone develops new techniques, I don't think you would find people living more than 120, 130 years, but you might find more people living to a longer part of their lifespan. Uncertain. Does that help? That's just my understanding. Okay. Yeah. You want to have a follow up? Okay. Okay. Like at the press conference.
Okay. This is on the topic of euthanasia, okay. Right? And then I'm sure we all know there's one famous scientist and all that. He kind of got tired of living up to 104 years.
They got tired of what?
He got tired of living up till 104 years old.
Oh, okay.
And he opted for euthanasia. So then I'm just thinking, it's kind of sad, right?
Who was this person?
He's a scientist, but I can't remember his name now.
Oh, okay.
Now.
Someone that has been in the news recently.
Yeah, somebody who lived in Australia, but he had to go to Switzerland, because Switzerland and Belgium are the two countries that endorse this euthanasia. So this borders on the topic of mercy killing, or yeah. I don't know.
So from for a Dharma practitioner, if you still have life and you still have the ability to think and meditate, it would be inadvisable to take your own life. Even if you're experiencing some amount of suffering, even though, you know, one has to be reasonable. Sometimes people cannot bear the suffering if they have a disease. Just being bored of life probably is not a very good reason to take. If he's, oh, I'm bored of life, I'm going to commit suicide. To think from a Dharma practitioner's point of view, you could be using that time to not only to benefit others, but maybe you're at a point where you're frail, you can't go out and affect the benefit of others, but you can leave imprints in your mind of developing these great realizations of renunciation, bodhicitta, the realization of emptiness. One of the great Tibetan scholars, Sakya Pandita, said that even on the day he was going to die, he should be reading, studying, learning more, meditating, because it's these actions that give the contour of our future lives. And if we really are serious to bring about benefit for ourselves and others, not only benefit of others, benefit of ourselves, to achieve enlightenment for ourselves, you know, to be without, to be like chilled out like the Arhat, but to be beyond that, blissed out like the Buddha, we need to create the causes of that. And so we don't know where we're going to be the next lifetime. If we were to commit suicide, or if we were to assist someone else committing suicide, we don't know where they're, we don't have the clairvoyance to know where they're going to be the next instant after they die. They might be in the hell realms. Had they lived a couple minutes longer, a couple weeks, months longer, experiencing some discomfort, they could have burned up karma that otherwise is now going to be experienced in hell. Sometimes the karma, if the karma, negative karma ripens as a human being, it ripens in a way that's less severe than if it ripens when we're born in a lower realm as an animal or as a hungry ghost or in the hell realms. So we don't know. We might think we're alleviating the suffering of someone, but we may be putting them in a situation where they'll end up with more suffering. So that's one thing. Yet, on the other hand, if we're motivated out of compassion and that person's mind is very not capable of enduring this suffering, I'm not saying that you should do this. I'm just saying that there's a Buddhist understanding that, you know, the main motivating factor that determines the karma we create is our motivation. So if our motivation is altruistic, even if it's not skillful, even though we want this person to be out of their suffering, even though, and we might assist them, the animal dying or someone dying, even though they might end up having more suffering, still we accrue some virtuous karma, but not total virtuous karma because of the effect. We were expecting them to be out of their misery. Maybe they have more misery now in the future. So it's a little bit of a unclear thing unless you are like some of the great beings that do exist today that have clairvoyance to know where that person will be reborn, you know, in the next instant, in the next moments, and so forth. So, but the main thing is our motivation. And in general, the Buddhist perception is that it's not a good thing to commit suicide. It's not a good thing to help others shorten their lifetimes. I know in American culture, when the horse, the racehorse or something, it can no longer run. If it's hurt its foot, then they take it, they shoot it. Is that common here also? They put it out of its misery as though the horse would be miserable that it can no longer run like it used to. From a Buddhist perspective, that's perhaps not so true, not so skillful. Because whenever we take life, whenever we give the order or the permission to take life, we create some kind of karma that is, to use a particular word, that is kind of aggressive. Okay, it's a kind of, even though we do it with a calm mind, a compassionate mind, it's a mind of severing someone's continuum. And that kind of mind of severing a person's continuum leaves an imprint in our mind in future lives, maybe to do it in other situations, to kill and to not feel any remorse about taking life and so forth. With respect to ourselves, as a Dharma practitioner, it's considered to be, say for instance, if you've received tantric initiations and so forth, it's considered to be a very negative action to take your own life because it's almost as though killing a deity that you had meditated on, you know. So it's something to think about. It's not a cut and dry answer. If you have clairvoyance, the bodhisattvas, you know, then I use your clairvoyance and see what's the best thing. If you don't have clairvoyance, maybe best to not to encourage that and to encourage people to live as long as they can and to endure the suffering. If they don't believe in reincarnation at all, if they're just in incredible suffering, maybe there's a cause. Sometimes in the hospice, people will be injected with a very strong sedative so that they're almost unconscious and in that state they will die naturally. So maybe that's not as bad as just, you know, like what was it, Dr. Death, Dr. Kevorkian, do you remember that one? Do you know who I'm talking about? Some gentleman who was advocating euthanasia. Euthanasia, sometimes people think, oh, there's a lot of young people in Asia? No, euthanasia, you didn't get youth in Asia. Okay, never mind. He was advocating this. And that particular state of mind begins then to devalue the value of the human life. You know, if you can just think, oh yes, life is so trivial that it, when any kind of problem comes, there's always this out. And can you imagine a future where this would be so common, you know, just some little problem in their life and then they would like to have be put under to die. It's a shame because it's not, they don't have an understanding of the value of this human lifetime. Okay, so let's just spend a moment to dedicate. I think we've created some good energy today, some understanding. Let's try to dedicate this energy. Usually in Buddhism, the three times of the time of the before an action, the motivation is the most important thing. We try to motivate before we did our lessons today. And at the end, and during the actual action, to do it with as precise and correct fashion, ethical fashion as possible. And at the end, to dedicate the virtuous karma that you've created so as to preserve it and to direct it into the most dharmically beneficial, you know, form. Your motivation actually can have an effect on the karma you've created, your dedication, thinking, due to this merit that I've created today, whatever good karma I've created, may it not ripen simply in some samsaric contaminated happiness. which it would otherwise, you know. But in whatever way it ripens, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development, year by year, decade by decade, life by life, due to these merits that I've created today, may they become the substance of my realizations of renunciation, bodhicitta, and an understanding, perfect understanding of emptiness. May they become the lifeblood of my bodhisattva practice, working for the benefit of others. And due to these merits, as a result of these merits, may they eventually lead me to my own enlightenment, where I can spontaneously and effortlessly work for the welfare of sentient beings in the most skillful, perfect way. So, Western New Year is coming when? Tomorrow night? Tomorrow night or Tuesday night? Tuesday night? Not tomorrow night. So, where they had the fireworks and everything? When's the New Year? On Wednesday or Wednesday? Pardon? Oh, Monday night there'll be fireworks. Okay. So enjoy the fireworks. And if you can join again next week, we'll continue these series of lectures. And have a happy new year. Oh, is this medicine? Is this for me? Someone? It's got corn in it, huh? I have to take it off.